today's Clean Internet Seminar, which will cover EPA's Brownfields Assessment Grant Guidelines. Today's session has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Brownfields out in Region 9. And bear with me, guys. I just had one little glitch on my computer. I apologize while I pull some things up. If you'll bear with me, I apologize. But this is usually the way things go, right when you're getting ready to do something. A little minor computer glitch. Okay, so today's Clean Seminar, again, is going to cover Brownfields Assessment Grant Guidelines. It's been sponsored by the EPA's Region 9 office. Before we get started, I'm going to provide a couple of housekeeping and reminder items so that everyone will be able to participate in today's session. When you signed up for today's Clue-In Seminar, you would have been directed to our seminar homepage, which has the title, description, and listing of all the presenters today, along with bios and contact information for, again, our presenters as well as myself. You'll want to be sure to take a moment to visit the Clue-In Seminar homepage to either pull up a copy of the presentation materials in your web browser window or locally download them as PowerPoint or PDF files. Again, you'll find those links on the seminar homepage. You'll also find them in the bottom of either the confirmation reminder email that you would have received from me today. So everyone should be starting on slide number one, the title slide. I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number two, which is our housekeeping slide. And if you haven't guessed it by now, Clue-In Seminars function very similar to conference calls. Each individual presenter will indicate as they move through the slides, and you as participants will be required to manually advance through the materials at their verbal cues. So for those of you just joining us on the telephone lines, I'm on slide number two, our housekeeping slide. If you're on a telephone line, we please ask that you take a moment now to place your phone on mute. You'll want to be sure to either use your own mute button or simply hit star 6 to mute your line. We do have time at the end of the presentation today for questions and answers with our speakers, and at that time, I'll remind you how to unmute your lines. But until then, simply hit star 6 to mute your phone lines. Please do not place the call on hold. There sometimes can be commercials or background noises that will be disruptive. So simply keep the phone lines on mute, and then again, I'll remind you how to take yourself off of mute when we get to the point for Q&A with our presenters. Those of you who are streaming simulcast don't have to worry about muting. You'll simply be listening to us through your computer speakers or headphones. When it comes to the Q&A portion with our presenters, those of you who are streaming the audio online will be able to take advantage of a question mark icon that appears as one of the orange buttons on the top of your slides. You guys will be able to type up your comments or questions electronically, and at the point for Q&A, I'll actually read those questions out loud to the speakers for you. Again, if you're looking at the slides in the web browser window, we're on slide number two. You'll see a series of numbered links that appear on the left-hand slide, which will help you to move through the materials as our presenters, again, announce as they page through, again, on slide number two. The orange icons along the top will also help you to move forward or backwards in the slides. The arrow pointing to the right will advance you one slide. The arrow pointing to the left will move you back one slide. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, that button with the question mark icon on the top will also, again, pop up a new window where you can type up your questions or comments, and I'll read them out loud on your behalf when we take a break for Q&A. Before we close out today's session, I'll point everybody to a few important reminder URLs, one where you can download a copy of the presentation material, as well as check out a few related websites and resources that have been collected for today's session. There'll also be a short link to our feedback form for today's session. If you're looking to get credit for today's seminar for participating, I'd encourage you to hang tight and get a little bit more information from me when we close things out, and I direct you to go into that seminar feedback form. Today's session will be recorded and automatically archived. It takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce the archive, and those of you who signed up for today's seminar will receive an email from me as soon as that archive is available to download and replay. And if you're interested, we have about 450 different archive seminars that are currently available on the Clue-In Seminar homepage. That's the end of the formal reminders that I have for everybody today. I heard a couple of beeps making sure you guys, again, are on mute. With that, I'm going to do the official introduction for today's session. I'll ask everybody to move along to slide number three, which is the beginning of the technical material today. Again, today's session is a Brownfields Assessment Grant Guidelines seminar, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Region 9 office. The webinar will focus on the Brownfields Assessment Grant program. Grants in this program will cover all Brownfields work prior to cleanup, including Brownfields inventory, phase one background on a property, phase two sampling to determine the extent of contamination at a site, and cleanup planning. Applicants to this program can choose to submit a community-wide assessment, which designates a target area from which many properties will be chosen for assessment work after the grant is awarded, to specific site property assessments where assessment work will focus on just one property. The panel will also review review applications from one entity versus coalition applications. The assessment grants are available only to governmental entities. We're joined by three speakers, one from EPA Region 8, 9, and 10. Christina Wilson is joining us from EPA Region 8 in the Brownfields Program out in Denver. Carolyn Douglas is joining us also from the Brownfields Program in Region 9 in San Francisco, California. And Terry Griffiths is joining us from EPA Region 10 in their Brownfields Program in Seattle. So with that, at 4:06, I'm going to turn things over to our presenters today. Again, all of our participants should be on slide number 3. Ladies?
Hello, good afternoon. This is Terry Griffiths, and as Jean pointed out, I work in the EPA Region 10 office in Seattle, Washington. Thanks for joining us today for a discussion of Brownfields Assessment Grants. We're on slide number 3. Please feel free to ask questions at the end of the presentation and also to contact us to continue a dialogue. Our goal with these outreach webinars is to increase the number of communities engaged in Brownfields reuse, and we appreciate your commitment to this effort. So with that, I'll move on to slide number 4. And what I'm going to do is run through the agenda and let you know how we've organized today's webinar. I'll be presenting the first part of the webinar with an overview of Brownfields and the Assessment Grant Threshold Criteria, or Eligibility Criteria, as we also call it. Then I'll hand the presentation off to Christina Wilson from Region 8 to discuss Assessment Grant Ranking Criteria. And Carolyn will follow with the last segment of the Ranking Criteria and move into Application Preparation Tips. And she'll run also through additional resources and contacts. So we are on slide number 5. And just a few reminders about what this session is and is not. It's not an introduction to Brownfields. So if you do wish for an overview of the EPA Brownfields program, please reference the archived copy of the July 12th webinar, Brownfields 101. And there's a link there for you to find that on our CLUIN website, from the Region 9 website. And this presentation doesn't cover the EPA cleanup or revolving loan fund or environmental workforce job training grant programs, and we'll have an upcoming slide, number 46, for additional training dates and times. And again, the slides from this presentation today will be available at the CLUIN or EPA Region 9 website, and the link is also provided there, the same link as above. So slide number 6, what's a brownfield? There are numerous definitions and ways of explaining brownfields. The one you see here, which you can read, is a quotation from the Brownfield Amendment of 2002 given to us by Congress. A real property to expansion, redevelopment, or reuse of which may be complicated by the presence or potential presence of a hazardous substance, pollutant, or contaminant. So in layman's terms, these are sites that are underused or utilized and blighted or have potential contamination, and there's a reuse potential. So moving to slide number 7. So what are the examples of typical brownfield sites? We provided some different sites, gas stations, factories, dump sites, lands impacted by mining, illegal drug labs, sick buildings, and we provided some photos there for you to get an idea of what these sites look like. The estimates of the number of brownfield sites in the U.S. range from 500,000 to over 1 million, and they exist in large and small communities. Sometimes they exist outside of populated areas such as mine-scarred lands. Brownfields generally are not contaminated enough or do not pose a substantial risk to human health and the environment, such as sites that we list in our Superfund program, or RCRA sites. Moving to slide 8, here's a snapshot of EPA's investment in brownfields to date. We provided some estimates there of how much we've awarded and how many assessment grants, revolving loan fund grants, and cleanup grants that we've given over over time since the inception of our program. And you can kind of look at the numbers there. It's quite a large number, and these funds have enabled us to assess more than 18,915 properties and leverage over $18 billion dollars in brownfield cleanup and redevelopment funding, generating also 75,000 jobs. In this year's program, EPA awarded over $69.3 million to assessment revolving loan fund and cleanup grants, and as well as supplemental funding for existing RLF grants. To give you an idea of how competitive these grants are, last year we received 683 proposals for 920 grant requests, totaling over $263 million in requests. So there's a lot of people coming in for these grants, very competitive. Slide number 9. So in our fiscal year 2013 competition, the upcoming competition, we estimate awarding approximately 219 grants among the three types, cleanup, revolving loan fund, and assessment, for a total of approximately $60 million. The majority of those we expect to be assessment grants, and we expect to award around 133 grants for approximately $34 million in funding. So keep in mind that these are very competitive, as I mentioned, and applicants should be prepared to put a lot of time and effort into constructing a winning proposal. So just to give you an idea of the timeline that we have for our upcoming fiscal year 2013 application process, we expect the actual guidelines to be released here any day, mid to late August. And that's what we call our request for proposals, or RFP. And the we provided a link there for you to go online and download the actual guidelines. And then we expect the proposal submission deadline to be sometime in October. Then in the spring, after we complete our process, which we'll describe today, we'll select and award about $34 million worth of grants. And in the next summer, we'll be finalizing actual grant work plans and completing the formal grant award process after the applicants have been selected. Slide number 11, a few reminders. Again, the FY13 proposal guidelines will be available online. And we've got two links there, one for the Brownfields program and then also at www.grants.gov. And again, remember that this training is not a substitute for reading and closely following the detailed guidelines. And there will also be frequently asked questions available online on our website that's provided there. Slide number 12. So what activities can an assessment grant fund? They're used to inventory, characterize, assess, and conduct planning and community involvement related to brownfield sites. There's a lot of flexibility, and you can use them to inventory, conduct phase one or phase two, plan and conduct community involvement. So there's a variety of ways they can be used, very flexible. And there are three ways to apply. There's a community-wide assessment from an individual applicant, a site-specific assessment from an individual applicant, or the third option is to come in with two or more other applicants, and come in as an assessment coalition. And essentially, that the assessment coalition is also a community-wide assessment. So the sites aren't necessarily selected up front there. So just a subset of community-wide, a different way to come in for a community-wide assessment. So slide 13, we provided a matrix with a summary of the three assessment grant options, and we'll review those over the next few slides. And please review this information closely. In the actual guidelines, call your regional brownfields coordinator and discuss your particular situation, your eligibility as necessary. And please keep in mind that these funding amounts that are listed here could change, be subject to change, so please, again, reference the guidelines. Slide 14. So here we've listed, we're starting to list the actual components of the various, the three assessment grant types. And remember that sites eligible for hazardous substance funding are those sites with a presence or potential presence of hazardous substance pollutants or contaminants, and sites that are contaminated with controlled substances or that are mine-scarred lands. And then petroleum contaminated sites must meet certain requirements to be eligible. And we define this under the Superfund law as crude oil or any fraction thereof, which is not specifically listed or designated as a hazardous substance under that section. So for additional details, see the appendix of the guidelines. The hazardous substance, that's petroleum, the definition that we use in the guidelines. So for community-wide, we can award up to $200,000 for hazardous substances and $200,000 for petroleum, and you can apply in one community-wide assessment proposal for both of those for a total of $400,000. And again, reference the guidelines for the specific amount. And then we have a second option here for site-specific, and again, that's for if you've identified a specific site in your community, and you can get up to $200,000 for petroleum or hazardous substances, or commingled. You're going to designate it as hazardous substances if the two types of contamination are commingled. So under site-specific, there's actually a waiver to go up to $350,000 per property, and there's a process, a write-up that you need to do to submit that with your proposal, and it's detailed in the guidelines. And again, no more than one property per eligible entity per year. So then the Assessment Coalition, which as I said is a subset of the community-wide type of assessment grant. And we're showing a projected maximum funding amount here, but again, refer to the guidelines for the actual number. In the Assessment Coalition, again, you can apply for both types of funding. And here's just an example, $350,000 hazardous, $250,000 petroleum, depending. You're going to have to try to guesstimate the numbers based on the amount of sites you project in each of those categories. The entities under the Assessment Coalition, there needs to be three or more eligible entities, and they must be separate legal entities. So, for example, you couldn't have three departments of the same state coming together. You could have an example might be a county, a city, and a urban renewal agency if it's separate than the city. So that could be a typical example of an assessment coalition group. The lead coalition member is the one who submits the proposal, and we will be the grant applicant and recipient of the grant should the proposal be selected. Coalition members are not eligible to apply for individual community-wide or site-specific assessment grants in the year they apply as part of the coalition. So keep that in mind. Only one proposal per year for each of the coalition members. Coalitions must have a memorandum of agreement in place prior to the expenditure of grant funds, and that'll be detailed more fully in the guidelines, and you can talk to your individual regions if you have questions about the Memorandum of Agreement, acronym is MOA. The proposal may be evaluated more favorably if the coalition plans to assess a minimum of 5 sites, and that's stated in the guidelines in the ranking criteria that Christina will be reviewing in a few minutes under Project Description and Feasibility of Success. So slide 16, this details the grant review process and that we go through when we receive the proposals, or applications as we also call them. There's a couple of steps, and under step one, we do what's called a threshold eligibility review. And under that step, we evaluate, so your ETA region, your home region, will evaluate the proposal eligibility criteria. And at that time, the region can answer any questions from applicants. They can answer questions ahead of time from applicants about eligibility. So we can answer any questions that you have about your eligibility. We cannot give you specific help with ranking, but we can answer any questions about eligibility, and we encourage you to contact us in advance about eligibility. During after your proposal is submitted, the region may call you to request more information or clarification on the threshold eligibility information that you provided. So we can request clarification on that part of the process. If the project does not meet threshold criteria, the application will not be ranked and you'll be notified. I'm just going to take a sip of water here for a second. Okay, and then the step two is the ranking process. And under that process, your proposal will, the ranking criteria in your proposal is then evaluated by a national panel. So that is not necessarily from the home region. It could be a mix of people and federal partners, what we call our federal partners. Could be from other EPA programs and also other agencies such as HUD, Housing and Urban Development, or USDA, U.S. Department of Agriculture. So we have a number of partners that will help us during this review process to evaluate the ranking criteria. And we, at that, you know, we cannot offer, as I said, direct assistance on the ranking portion. We do it through these forums, but it has to be a public forum so that the competition maintains its fairness. Historically, proposals tend to pass the threshold criteria. Normally, most of our proposals pass the threshold, but sometimes, you know, obviously, it's very competitive, so they don't necessarily rank high nationally. And so what we're trying to do here is help you get as many points as possible. And again, Christina will be reviewing the ranking criteria in a few minutes. Slide number 17. So the threshold are must-pass, and the first most important threshold criteria is applicant eligibility. You must be one of the eligible types of applicants listed in the guidelines, and we'll go over that in the next slide. You must have a current letter acknowledging your project from the state or tribal environmental authority. It must be current dated this year. And please, you know, allow enough time to get your proposal completed and submit the proposal to your state or tribal environmental authority so that they can review it and provide a letter. That does take some time because they're getting other proposals in as well. So what the letter does is acknowledges that the applicant plans to conduct assessment activities and is planning to apply for an EPA grant. And remember that if you're submitting multiple proposals, you may have one letter from the state addressing all of your projects. Just make sure that you submit a copy with each proposal. So don't forget to submit the copy. And so you must pass the site submitting a site-specific application, you must also pass the site eligibility and property ownership eligibility as well. Under community-wide, including the coalition assessment grant, successful applicants will submit the eligibility information to their EPA project officer for their grant as the sites are selected. So we don't need that information up front under the community-wide assessment. So under applicant eligibility, slide 18, we have several eligible entities listed there, general purpose units of local government, state, quasi-governmental entities such as regional councils, redevelopment authorities, economic development agencies, Indian tribes other than in Alaska, and if you are from Alaska, give us a call and we can help guide you through that process of determining eligibility. And but in Alaska, the Alaskan Native Regional and Village Corporations and Metlakatla Indian Community are eligible. And under the assessment program, nonprofit organizations are not eligible to apply. However, they are eligible under cleanup. So if you have questions, again, contact your EPA Regional Brownfields Coordinator listed in Section 7 of the guidelines, and we will work with you to determine eligibility before you submit your proposal. And we're more than happy to do that. Okay, moving on to slide 19, we have, here we're talking about specifically about coalition applicants. Remember, there can be three or more coalition members. They all must be separate legal entities, and they all must be eligible to apply under assessment grants. So they need to be one of those listed eligible entities. And remember to include in your proposal, if you're applying as a coalition applicant, that you need documentation that all members are eligible entities. So you're going to explain why they're eligible. And then you're also going to submit a letter from each coalition member agreeing to be part of the coalition. That's very important. Next slide, slide 20. So this just has some requirements for the letter that you're going to get from your state or tribal environmental authority. Remember, it needs to be current. I think someone out there might should put their phone on mute. We're getting a little bit of feedback. Thank you. So remember, it must be current. And again, acknowledge the project, the specific project. And again, this is also important, not just for the letter to provide with the application, but also to start a relationship with your state agency, which is really critical to the project. So they can start to advise you about your project and work with you on the project. And they'll be an integral partner on the grant as well as EPA. So if you're applying for multiple grant types, again, you can get one letter that acknowledges all of those projects that you're applying for, all the proposals that you're submitting to EPA. But again, provide a copy with each proposal. And again, provide your state or tribal environmental authority with sufficient notice, because they're getting a lot of requests for letters. Next slide, slide 21. And here we're just briefly, a snapshot of what the requirements are for site-specific applications. So there's liability information that you need to provide. And remember that the Brownfield Law prohibits EPA from providing grant funds to any entity that is considered potentially liable for a subject site. So the liability is determined by how and when the site was acquired, and therefore site eligibility is dependent on how and when the site was acquired. So the bottom line is contact EPA prior to beginning your application if you're applying for site-specific, so we can help you determine eligibility. We don't want you to spend a lot of time if the site doesn't appear to be eligible, and we can go over the requirements of what you need to do to protect yourself from liability if you're purchasing the site. So in the proposal, you're going to demonstrate that you're not a liable party by establishing that you meet the requirements of one of the liability protections or defenses set forth in CERCLA. And there's a lot of specific requirements to meet. So, again, we can run through those with you and work with you on that prior to your submission of the application. I'm not going to go through those now, but please give us a call. Love to hear from you. Okay, slide number 22, and what I'm going to do now is I'm going to pass off the presentation to Christina Wilson from our Region 8 office, and she's going to start in on the discussion of the ranking criteria. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. This is Christina Wilson. Again, I'm in the Region 8 office in Denver, and here we have a picture of a mine site in Colorado that went from assessment through cleanup. This is the ranking criteria section. And so once it's determined that you pass the threshold criteria, your proposal is given to EPA reviewers to be ranked based on your responses to the criteria that we'll be going over in this next section of the webinar. So on to slide 23. The ranking sections are divided into four different sections, 200 points total. You'll want to look at the guidance to see exactly the breakout. We have a pretty good idea of what they're going to be, though. You have the community needs, the project description, feasibility, and success, community engagement and partnerships, and the project benefits. Each criterion is made up of several sub-criteria, and so be sure to answer each individually. And one thing that one, it will look like it's one question, it's sort of grouped together in a paragraph, but that one paragraph can have up to four different questions it's asking. So it's really important that you read through that and that you answer each question that's in those paragraphs. And another thing, when we're reading through these, what's really helpful to the reviewer is if you label your proposal the same way that we label the guidelines, it tends to be, when it's easier for us to give you points, you tend to score higher. So we would definitely recommend that you try to mirror the labeling scheme that we have. And each of the sections in the ranking criteria also has a paragraph that precedes the actual question being posed. And be sure to read not only the actual questions, but this additional text as well. It can really help guide you as to what exactly the reviewers of your proposal are looking for in your responses. So next slide, on slide 24. The first section is the community needs section. This section is worth approximately 20% of the total points possible. And under this criterion, proposals are valued on both the applicant's description of the health, welfare, and environment in addition to the financial needs of your targeted community. And this is a really important section because it sort of sets the tone for the rest of your application. You want to be sure to let the reviewer know early on in the review why you need this grant. So, moving on to 25. So the first sub part of this is the community, of the community need is the health, welfare, and environment. It asks you here, we want you to describe the type, the number, the size, the location of the brownfields in your community, and the typical contamination. And it's also, you're describing your targeted community here. And this is the opportunity to tell the reviewer of your proposal a story. It's where you set the stage for the rest of the information you are going to, that you're going to provide in your proposal. So do your best to make the story you're telling a compelling one. And remember that the reviewer is not familiar with your community. Therefore, don't make any assumptions that there's an understanding of your particular community or situation. Really spell it out for us as much as possible. Also asked for here are additional environmental issues in your community. And this was added last year, and what it is, we're looking for more of an overall view of your target community. So for you to expand on environmental issues beyond just brownfields, and if there are some environmental justice issues in your target area, this is a really good place to mention this. And additionally included here is a discussion of sensitive populations in your community. I think this is a question that I often see is not addressed. Folks will typically skip over this, and then you automatically lose points if you don't address it. So really be sure to answer all parts of the questions. And just remember to please identify all your information sources. If you have great data, but there's no nothing to back it up, it's harder to give you those points. So please include sources of your information. Slide 26. This is the financial needs section. We ask for you to describe the economic impact of brownfields on the target community. And this includes, we ask the rates of poverty, household income, unemployment. And this is really a two-part question. Part of this is asking for your data in a table, which I'll touch on the next slide. But even more important here is the supporting text for the tabulated data. So really be sure to, this is another opportunity to really describe your community. And then another question here is other widely available demographic information. And one thing I'd recommend here, there's starting last year, and it's going to be included this year again, is the section called Special Considerations. It's in the appendix of the guidelines. And there are things for small communities or communities that are impacted by natural disasters. There's a long list of what we are calling special considerations. What I would recommend you do here is look at those special considerations, and then if any of those apply to your community, include a discussion here and really call out those the things that make your community that are on the list there. And one part of this criterion that we often see skipped over is making the link between the brownfields in your community and how it affects the local economy. One way to address this is if you could try to quantify the diminished tax revenue that's a direct result of the abandoned or idle properties that you plan to address. Moving on to slide 27, here's the table that I mentioned. So we will fill in the guidelines, this last column here for the national, that will be filled in the RFP. We leave it up to you to fill in the rest. And one thing I want to stress is that if there are other indicators of need in your community, you're not limited to these. These are examples of what you can provide, and we strongly recommend you provide these. But if there are other things that demonstrate your need or paint a unique picture of your target community, you can definitely add more columns to this, or more rows to this table. Moving on to slide 28. This is the project description and feasibility of success section. This section of the application is worth half of the total overall points. So be sure to really focus your attention on this section. Wherever possible, if there is a community master plan, this is where you would touch on that and tie in your assessment proposal with the master plan. Another thing that we're looking for here, proposals where the majority of the budget is going toward conducting site assessments, those proposals are going to be viewed more favorably than those that focus primarily on inventory or planning activities. Inventory and planning is allowed, and some of that's definitely included, but we don't want all of your resources to be focused on that. And what Terry had mentioned earlier, for assessment coalitions, they'll be viewed more favorably if there are a minimum of 5 sites. It's not a requirement, but we strongly recommend it. Moving on to slide 29. This is discussing the project description and feasibility success, and this section is broken up into several subsections. The first in this is the project description. And this is your opportunity to really elaborate on your overall plan for the future of your targeted area. If your targeted community has a master plan, include details here. Don't just mention it. Really highlight how you're going to tie in with that plan. And just keep in mind that EPA receives a lot of assessment proposals each year. And the ones that get funded are those that demonstrate a strong vision and a well-thought-out path toward obtaining that vision. So the further along you are there, this is where you can really highlight that, the work that you've already done, if that's applicable to you. Moving on to slide 30. Here's the budget table. And as reviewers, we often see really elaborate tables, but then no associated text. And I want to stress that both are needed for maximum points. The narrative is your opportunity to detail as best as possible how you have calculated your costs. We really encourage you not just to have an overall number for several phase one and phase two assessments. It would really help to include how much you anticipate paying for each phase one, each phase two, and that's how you come up with those numbers. Something to note too, administrative costs are not allowed. Programmatic costs, however, are. There's an appendix in the guidelines that will detail this, and I recommend you check that out for specifics on what can and cannot be covered. But just real briefly, grant funds cannot be used for indirect costs of grant administration, with the exception of financial and performance reporting. Also, grant funds cannot be used for proposal preparation costs. Moving on to slide 31. Here is the budget table. Again, this is provided in the guidelines. What we typically see broken out by the tasks, typically we have program development and outreach, inventory prioritization. Another task would be conducting phase one, phase two site assessments, with a fourth one being cleanup planning and remedial action plans. If you are requesting both hazardous substance and petroleum dollars, please use two tables. Do not just include one. Break it out by how much you want for each. Then moving down here, in terms of travel, it's worthy to note that travel to brownfields-related conferences is an acceptable use of the grant funds. As far as equipment, EPA defines equipment as items that cost $5,000 or more with a useful life of more than 1 year. Items costing less than $5,000 are considered supplies. And generally, equipment is not required for assessment grants. And then in terms of contractual, applicants must comply with the procurement procedures contained in 40 CFR Part 31. So I would recommend that you check that out. Moving on to slide 32, tracking and measuring. Quarterly reports are required throughout the grant period. So one thing that you want to note, instead of just saying you'll submit quarterly reports, what to give more detail would help your proposal, and note what measures will be included in your quarterly reports, such as the number of community meetings, the number of assessments. Try to quantify what you're going to include those reports. And also, acres is something that when you're awarded a grant, we require that you report in acres. If you are not familiar with acres yet, it's definitely worth your time to take a few minutes to research it so you can properly address this in the tracking criteria in here. To be able to speak about reporting in acres would definitely help you out. It makes you sound like you know what you're talking about. And then if you have any other tracking mechanisms that you're going to use, here is also where you would describe those. Moving on to slide 33. I am leveraging, we're still under the project description, feasibility of success. If you determine that additional work may be required, we ask that you describe the funding or resources that you will have or you will seek to complete this additional work. It should be noted that any leveraging commitments that are identified in your proposal should be supported and detailed in letters from the given source. And if there's not supporting documentation in the form of a support letter, the commitments described in your proposal will not necessarily earn you additional points. So we really need documentation to back it up. And then for any in-kind leveraging that you may have, what I think helps is if where possible you can put an associated cost to what a given resource may be worth. And it sort of bulks up your leveraging, and I would recommend that you look into that. Moving on to slide 34. This is the last section in the project description and feasibility of success section. It's programmatic capability and past performance. The first thing that we ask for here is that you clearly demonstrate your ability to manage grants and oversee the proposed work. Part of this is we ask if there have been any adverse audit findings. We typically see that if there are not, or we assume there are not, people just do not mention it. If you have not had any adverse audit findings, please make note of it. It's by a simple one sentence saying, we have had no adverse audit findings, and that's enough. If you do not address it, we're going to assume you will not get full points. And another area where we often see applicants missing points for not addressing all the sub-criteria, in the past performance, if you look at what is being asked for past performance, if you've had EPA grants or non-EPA grants, it asks for the funding expenditure, the compliance, the accomplishments. So what we're looking at here is more than just a list. Really go through each of these and be sure that you address it. And not necessarily lengthy, but be sure that it's not ignored, because then you will not get full points. And then it should be noted that you'll get a neutral score if you have never received any type of federal or non-federal assistance agreements. So you could get a neutral score if you note that you have not, but if you skip over entirely, it could result in a zero. So be sure to really read the questions and answer them where you can. Moving on to slide 35. And we're in the community engagement and partnership section, and this section is worth 15% of your total proposal. Here we're looking for how you plan to engage your target community and how you have both identified and established the relationships with appropriate partners to ensure success. And here again, we're looking for letters. And please don't underestimate the importance of support letters. A proposal can be really well written and nail every question, but without the associate support letters, it will not earn enough points to be awarded. So really work on getting those letters. You do not want form letters. You really want to have folks write letters that state something specific for your project. Moving on to slide 36. So part of the Community Engagement Partnerships, this is where we ask you to describe your plan for community involvement in site selection, cleanup planning, and site reuse planning. And those applicants who have already engaged the community in the process will definitely be scored more favorably. We strongly encourage you to be proactive and begin this process as soon as possible, and it will definitely help you in your application. Slide 37, in partnerships. Here is where we want you to describe your efforts and plans to develop partnerships with local, state, or tribal environmental and health agencies. And there is an and here. It's not either or. Oftentimes we see something detailing a partnership with a state, but it doesn't then go to the state health agency as well. So please do both. If there are other relevant federal and state governmental agencies, please include them here. And also we ask for any local environmental job training programs in your immediate area. Some communities have EPA job training programs. If they are in your community, it would definitely help you to involve those graduates in any work you may be doing where it's possible. If you do not have local environmental job training programs, EPA or non-EPA, please state that. And then some of these, not all of them, will apply to you, but you just need to let us know if it does not apply rather than just assuming that if you don't state so, we're going to assume it doesn't apply. So please state if there are not. And I think we are now moving on to Carolyn.
Okay. Hi, I'm here. I was on mute. Thank you,
right.
Christina. That was
Skip one slide, Carolyn. This is Christina. I skipped the slide of the community-based organizations on slide 39. I'm sorry. So if you can give examples of a community-based organization. Here we have a list of examples of community-based organizations. You definitely want to include their roles as well. A table format works well here to include the community-based organizations you're going to involve and what their role will be. And now, now I'm going to pass it over to Carolyn.
So thank you, Christina. Glad you brought that back up. What I'd like to do now is to assist you in telling the last part of your story. And I'm going to slide number 39. Sorry, slide 40, Project Benefits. And this part of the story, you want to tell how your project's anticipated outcomes will be demonstrated. Do they promote general welfare through the improvement of public health and safety, the economy, and the environment of the targeted community? And will these benefits contribute to the overall community's vision for the revitalization of the brownfield sites that you will be addressing? Next slide. We also asked the question for you to tell us how welfare and the public health outcome will be demonstrated. Describe how the site assessments will lead to cleanups and redevelopment that supports your proposed project. You want to describe the social and public health benefits anticipated from the revitalization of the site assessed under this grant, and describe the efforts that you have taken to integrate equitable development principles into the reuse of the site and not displace residents historically affected by brownfields. This is an area where you will address some of your environmental justice issues that go along with the site. On the next slide, number 42, we are talking about economic benefits and or green space. Here you want to explain what the economic benefits will be and what will be generated from your project. Will there be an increase in employment? Will there be an expanded tax base? And those are coming about as a result of the redevelopment of the sites that you are accessing. One of the most important things we'd like to see in you telling that story is to quantify what would be the increase in the employment. You could give us a percent-wise what that would be. What would be the percent of increase in the expanded tax base? So another thing we want to hear about is whether or not there would be any non-economic benefits associated with the sites that will be used for green space or perhaps some other non-profit activity. Now, this particular sub-criterion says you would address and or. So sometimes the question does come up, do I have to address all of it? The reality is, if you have a nonprofit activity that will be one of the benefits, we would love to hear that. If you have a non-economic benefit, we want to hear about that. So don't stress over it. We just would like to have the answers that are appropriate for your project. So moving on to the next slide, 43, project benefits. We want to look at the environmental benefits from the infrastructure reuse and the sustainable reuse. Number one, we want to know whether or not you will be reusing the infrastructure that's already there. For example, your water, your sewer, your electricity, and the roads. And we'd like for you to be specific about what is available there. If there is a need to put in new infrastructure, just say so. It's just important to give us a very good picture of what your vision is and what your project is supposed to do. Describe how the grant will help facilitate sustainable reuse. Once again, be specific about what your project will do. What will be the outcome? Look at your public transit. Will it continue to be used? Will it become better? Will there be green buildings associated with this project? Will there be increased green buildings? What about your energy efficiency? Let's consider your stormwater management. How will that be impacted? How will it be improved? Will there be green remediation applied to your cleanup project? What about the diesel emission reductions and renewable energy productions? All of these are things that you would want to consider in this particular section. The next slide is special considerations. When you review the assessment guidance, this is considered under other factors, and I think it should be once the guidelines actually come out toward the back of the guidelines, around pages 35, 36, someplace in there. There are actually other factors that should be considered for your project, and you may want to tell us a little bit about that. Christina explained to you a little bit earlier how you could explain if you have some special economic situations that may have occurred in your targeted community that could be considered for why you're applying for this grant, why you need to have this money. This would be a thing that you want to do. You want to characterize how the other factors really apply to your site. You want to look at the needs of the communities, how they've been affected by any natural disasters. You want to tell us if the community has experienced any plant closures and what was the economic disruption that was associated with that. Tell us whether or not you are a recipient of a Brownfields Area-Wide Planning Grant. That's something new for us that we are, you know, looking at more and more. And are you a recipient of a HUD DOT EPA Partnership for Sustainable Communities Grant? And if it's directly connected to your project area. If so, just let us know about that. Tell us about it. Moving on to the next slide. We want to give you some useful application tips, you know, for preparing your application. I'm on slide 46. it is very, very important for you to read the entire new fiscal year 13 guidelines and to follow those directions. It's important, if possible, for you to get mentoring from prior grantees who have applied for the Brownfields Assessment Grant. When you prepare your grant proposal, you want to write your story as though the reader, the grant evaluator, or the proposal evaluator knows nothing about your community. The truth of the matter is that people from across the country could be reviewing your proposal and they may not be associated with your area or the kind of condition you're dealing with, but you want to be able to characterize it such that they're able to perhaps see it through your eyes. You want to address each and every criteria and the sub-criteria that are applied there. If it does not, a criteria or criteria does not apply to your project, don't just blow it off. Just say that it doesn't apply and explain why it doesn't apply. That's much more helpful than not saying anything, because it appears if you don't provide some kind of response that you're not addressing that and you probably won't receive any scoring for that. You should follow and include the guidelines numbering, as Christina explained to you earlier. It's so much easier for the evaluators to find your answers to the questions that are being asked in the criteria if you were to do that. Next slide.
Carolyn, before you carry on, I just wanted to do a quick time check. We're coming up near 5 p.m. Eastern, which is the scheduled end time. So I just wanted to let everyone know that we're going to keep going past that time so you guys can get through the materials. And we'll probably only have about 5 minutes or so to get through the questions, but we are going to keep going until you guys have managed to cover all of the materials and we at least take a few questions. Okay?
Okay, and I will get speedy here.
All right,
On slide 47, you find some additional tips. Use the proposal checklist at the end of the ranking criteria. This is very useful to make sure that you have addressed all of the criteria that are there. We would like for you to avoid using acronyms and technical organizational jargon. That throws people off. We don't know what you're talking about. Use white space and obey the page limits. The page limit is 17. That does not include the 2-page cover letter. All right, consider the breakdown of the points across the 4 criteria and then give each proportional attention and space pages. When you set up your page, use 1-inch margins, use a 12-point font, no binders, no color pictures. Don't do that. Don't do anything that throw the reviewers off. Limit your attachments to only the required and relevant documents and letters that we are asking for. Avoid sending maps and photos as they don't reproduce well. Moving to the next slide, 48. You want to contact the state, tribal, EPA authority with threshold and eligibility questions as soon as you know that you are applying for a grant for your particular site. Any partners that you may have for your project, call them and ask for assistance in preparing and reviewing your proposal. Sometimes another eye to read your proposal before you submit it is a good thing because they can help point out some things that you may want to improve upon. If you need to set up public meetings, do that as soon as possible and get meaningful public input on your proposed project before you submit that to us. Tie into previous and ongoing master planning efforts and economic development initiatives and explain how the proposed project fits into and benefits these efforts and your stakeholders. Next slide. We have some upcoming trainings and workshops that will follow this one. On August the 25th, we will have a webinar for the Revolving Loan Fund Program. On August the 30th, there's the Cleanup Grant Program or webinar, and we'll have some Q&As for people who are interested in just having their questions answered about any of these grants. That will occur on October the 6th. The active webinars that, the archive webinars will be available to you at the link below. You will find the Brownfields 101. You'll find a detailed review of the guidelines for the assessment, RLF, and the cleanup grants that will be presented later on. Next slide is grant guideline resources. You can read these here. This is just general information, and I'm just moving along so that we can get through. You want to learn more about the FY13 grant proposal process. Here is just a flyer that lets you know that. Here are the contacts for Region 8, Region 9, Region 10. If you're not in either one of these regions, please contact the regional Brownfields coordinator in your region. Those people will be able to assist you with your questions specific to your region. Here are the contacts for the state of Colorado, Montana, North Dakota in Region 8, South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming in Region 8. For Region 9, we have the contacts for Arizona, California, California State Water Resources Board, Hawaii, and Nevada. This slide, 57, you have your contacts for Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington Department of Ecology. Once again, we'd like to let you know what the timeline is. Mid to late August, we expect for the request for proposals for the ARC grants to be available. The proposal deadline is in October 2012, and that depends on when the proposal, the RFPs are released. We will be selecting proposals and announcing them in the spring of 2013, and in the summer of 2013, we will start working on finalizing work plans and making grant awards for those that are selected. Next slide is, are there any questions?
It's wonderful. Okay, so we're just a little bit past our scheduled end time, and we're going to take about 5 minutes or so to go through questions. I do have a number of them that have been submitted online. I'm going to take just a minute to see if anybody on the phone lines, though, has a question before I start reading the electronic ones. So if you've joined us by telephone and haven't typed up a question online, please feel free to take yourself off of mute and ask your question or make a comment. And it's #6 if you need to locally unmute. Can you use our previous *6 command? So #6 to unmute.
Okay. I have a question about the $34 million.
Sure, go right ahead.
Is that the estimate for the assessment grants, or is that the estimate for all ARC grants?
Oh, I believe that's the estimate for the assessment grants.
That's the estimate for assessment grants.
Okay. And anybody else on the telephone lines with a question? Again, it's #6 to unmute, and feel free to identify yourself or organization before asking a question. Alrighty. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go through these questions online. And if Carolyn, Christina, and Terry could be unmuted so we can get through them as quickly as possible, I'd greatly appreciate it. So the very first question is coming in from Seattle, Washington, and they ask, is there any advantage or disadvantage to applying for separate hazardous substance and petroleum community-wide grants versus applying for a combined community-wide grant for both hazardous substances and petroleum? So I guess what's the advantage if you do it separately for these grants or if you try to do a combined community-wide grant?
I think as far as the competition goes, you'd be best served to just do one application. It would save you the time, and from our point of view, I think it would read the same as if you did it combined.
Okay,
great. So that would be my recommendation.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Olympia, Washington, and I believe you may have actually addressed this when you were going through the last few slides, but they're looking for clarification on exactly what agency serves as a, quote, state authority.
That's correct. Those slides do identify the state authorities that we're working with.
Okay, great. So again, in some cases, it's a state regulatory agency. In others, it may include a water organization, like I think you showed one for California.
Yeah, California has a bunch. Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Go ahead.
So, Jean, this is Terry. Just, I mean, if they're not in one of the Region 8, 9, or 10, then they should just contact their brownfields coordinator if they're not sure which state environmental authority they need to get a letter from. That would be my recommendation.
Great. Our next question is coming in from Hawaii, and they ask, are for-profit non-governmental entities eligible to apply for assessment grants?
No, they're not.
Sorry, but that's a no.
Okay. Moving right along, again, coming in from Seattle, Washington. How can an applicant who is applying for community-wide funds do a good job of providing detailed information on things like leveraging of funds, creation of green space, use of existing infrastructure, and final redevelopment when the sites have not yet been pre-identified? Again, I can read that question again if you'd like. So they're concerned about community-wide funds when you're applying for that and you haven't identified the sites just yet before you submit your application. How can you give detail on things like leveraging funds, creating green space, using existing infrastructure, et cetera, when you don't know exactly what sites you're going to be targeting for the community-wide grant?
Well, this is Carolyn. One of the activities that you can do under your community-wide grant is to develop an inventory. But I think you should consider, have you ever leveraged funds for any kind of redevelopment project before? You want to demonstrate your ability to leverage funds and tell us what that was about and how successful you were.
Okay, great.
Another recommendation would be you could identify some potential sites and work from the assumption that, you know, there could be a few sites that you know you're going to look at, and go on that assumption. Also, you can look into other resources in your community. You know, if there's a community development block grant, you can leverage that. If there are different programs, or organizations that can help, just with general redevelopment and such, you would want to contact them and see what they could do. So it might be early, but you'd want to start the process and identify as much as you can about resources that you could look into.
Great.
So to add on to that, when you're identifying your target area, I think it's really important that you, as Christina mentioned, you're going to look at potential sites, types of sites, that you might be working on, and kind of paint a picture for the reviewer of what kinds of things may result, what the project benefits are. So use anecdotes or use examples from past projects that you may have worked on. But you really need to get specific. And again, you know, anything that you can demonstrate, any partners and possible funds or in-kind services, things like that, with your community-based organizations or with your funding partners, all of that helps to paint a picture of and show how you're going to be successful with your project.
Okay. This next question is coming in from New Jersey, and it's just a simple question on the date. They ask, August 25th is a Saturday. Is this the correct date? So is October 6th.
We actually don't have a date.
The date for the guidelines release, or?
It's referencing August 25th and October 6th, and I know there were a number of dates that were included on the last few slides, so I'm not sure.
I think the wisdom is that EPA does not publish that stuff on the weekends.
I don't know where the information is coming from.
I don't either.
So, but we do expect the guidelines to be released, you know, at some point before the end of August. And it's usually about 60 days or
think the question is regarding the upcoming webinars that are referenced on one of the slides.
Oh, okay. Oh. Yeah, the last few slides, I think there were a number of dates that were put up there.
Okay.
It might just simply be a typo. I'm trying to page through
I think so. We'll have to check those.
Yeah, they're definitely not webinars on Saturday. That I can confirm from the GLUIN standpoint.
The 24th is the cleanup and the 30th is the RLS of this month for those webinars.
Okay, so I think they're it's slide number 49. The RLS grant is listed as August 25th, and that's a typo, correct?
Those could be found online at the link. I apologize if those are. I think there's another slide, too, embedded that has, if you go to slide 51, it actually shows the dates there. And then there's a link to the Region 9 site that takes you to GLUIN. So it's August 23rd and August 30th for those webinars.
Excellent. Okay. All right. So I'm going to try to get through just a few more questions and hopefully close things up by 5:15. I appreciate everybody staying a little bit late with us before we address the questions here. So the next question is coming in from Portland, Oregon, and they ask, it was mentioned that neutral points are awarded to entities that have not previously received EPA grants. What points are awarded to the entities that have received previous EPA grants? Is this viewed positively or negatively?
So that, assuming that you've been successful with your EPA grants, you are awarded more than a neutral score. You need to show your past successes, and so this can be, it was just, we don't want to dock folks that have not had previous grants, so this was the way that we came up with, not penalizing them, but if you have had previous grants, state how you've been successful, and you can be awarded up to full points there.
Great. There's two questions that came in, one from Reston, Virginia, the other from Seattle, Washington, but I think they're both related to each other, so I'm going to read them together. The first one asks, is it possible to get examples of prior successful applications for community-wide grants? And then the next question asks, there on slide 46, you have a link to prior grantees. Is there a database of historical applicants, and how might one review past proposals? Do they have to go through a FOIA?
So a resource where they have where you can see examples of successful proposals is TAB-EZ. It's TAB, and then E, and a Z, .org. If you go there, there's a link for sample grant applications, and there are several examples you can look at through there, and that's where I'd recommend one would look.
Are there community-wide examples there, do you know?
Community-wide examples are there as well, yes.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. All right, two more questions. The next one's coming in from Hawaii, and they ask, can you clarify the spring awards versus the summer grant work plans? Work plans are prepared by applicants for the assessment work prior to the award, correct?
Well,
so
what spring...
Go ahead. Well,
the spring announcement will be those proposals that were selected for funding. And in the summer, we will actually start working on getting the work plan award in place.
Okay. Were there any other clarifying statements you guys wanted to add on to that? Or throw and nail it?
Yeah, I think the word award is a little confusing because we're talking about the selection process where we announced the grants or the proposals that were selected for funding, and then the next phase is where the EPA project officer works with the applicant to create a formal application package and work plan that will be the basis of the grant award.
Ah, okay.
So, the grant award is the official award that funds the project, and the work plan is the basis for that. So the question, work plans are prepared by applicants for assessment work prior to award, is yes.
Okay. Great. And our last question that's been submitted online is an anonymous question, and they ask, so if I am considered to be a PLP as a city or municipal agency, then I will not be able to use the funds from the program for Phase 2 Interim Action or ECAP. Is that correct? Could the funds be used for a site assessment?
Not eligible.
That's an easy one to answer. Excellent.
You know, but it would depend on how you acquired the property. If you are, you know, if, and I assume this is a PRP, if you are a PRP, then no. If you're a city or municipality who acquired it through delinquent taxes or something, you did your due diligence, you could be eligible.
Okay.
And the other thing is that if someone else applies, if another entity applies, then that entity could be eligible for assessing the property that is owned by a PRP. I mean, it just depends. But again, it's important to talk to your EPA region about the specifics, just to be completely clear.
Okay. Okay, excellent. All right, we've come up on 5:16 p.m. Eastern, so I'll give our three presenters a chance to make any closing statements or any reminders just before I begin the official closeout for today. Anything you'd like to leave your participants with, ladies, before I move them on to the feedback form?
Well, this is Carol in Region 9. I thank you for being present here today. I would like to encourage you, no matter what region you're in, to contact your regional brownfields coordinator and pose your questions to them. Ask for their assistance. Ask for their help, because they're there for that particular reason and they're willing to help you out. Thank you.
Thank you. Christina, anything?
No, thank you.
No problem. Carrie, anything?
Just thank you for attending, and second what Carolyn said, just please give us a call and we're happy to talk with you. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So with that, I'm going to ask everyone to move on to slide number 60, which is the second to last slide, our resources and feedback slide. The very first link you'll find there is a link to the additional resources page. If you're not sitting at a computer with internet access or just have a printed copy, those hyperlinks can also be found on the seminar homepage. There are buttons that appear on the left that will say links, and as well as one for the feedback form. And those will be up and active indefinitely, so if you want to come back tomorrow or next week, you'd certainly go check those out. But I would encourage you to take a look at the resources or links page, which has an opportunity to download the presentation materials, as well as take a look at the websites that were referenced, like TAD-EZ and the Regional Brownfields Program. If you're looking to find your regional brownfields coordinator, the links again on the resources page will help direct you to the right person. The other link that you'll find on slide number 60 is our short feedback form. I would encourage you to take just a minute to fill it out. It's a very brief form, and I do read each and every one of the responses that are posted through that site. So if you found this to be a useful expenditure of your time today and you'd like to continue to see free training like this offered through Kluin, please take a moment to fill out the form and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you are sharing the line with multiple participants, once you submit feedback, there'll be a link that will appear to let someone else hop on and fill out their own feedback form. If you were looking to receive credit for your participation today, while we don't necessarily issue CEUs or PDHs from Kluin directly, when you fill out the feedback form, there's an option to check a box to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. If you keep that confirmation email, which will at least verify that you submitted feedback at the conclusion of today's session, along with a copy of the presentation materials and your registration email, that may be enough to earn credit from your accrediting institution. Again, I would encourage you, when you fill out that form, make sure that your email address is entered correctly. That's the only way you'll get that confirmation email sent to you. I'm going to ask everybody to move along to the next slide, which is the final slide, slide number 61. Just a bit of an advertisement for us here at Kluin. We're constantly trying to find new ways to connect with our target audience. So if you are part of LinkedIn, Twitter, or Facebook, you'll also find the Cleanup Information Network website presence there, and you're certainly welcome to connect or follow with us on either, or pardon me, any one of those methods listed again on slide 61. So at 5:20, I apologize for the extended time to complete today's session, but I do appreciate both our organizers as well as our presenters and the over 120 individuals who joined us from all over the United States to stay on the line so we can complete today's seminar. Again, I want to echo my thanks to the individuals from EPA Regions 8, 9, and 10 who were able to organize today's session and deliver it.
I also want to thank those of you who joined us and gave us about an hour and 25 minutes of your time for today's session. As the presenters mentioned, when they close things up, there will be another seminar as part of this series. I believe they said coming up on August 23rd, so next week, which will further look at the Complete Brownfield Grants Program that we have available here at EPA. So I encourage you to take a look at the links provided in today's slides that you'll be able to find the upcoming seminar and actually sign up for that session if you're interested. Today's session was recorded and will be archived in about 1 to 2 weeks. You will automatically get an email from me with the links. You're welcome to actually forward that on to any colleagues that you think will find it useful. Again, thank you all for joining us today. This will be the formal conclusion for today's seminar. I hope you have a great rest of your day and that we'll see you or hear from you soon on a future CLUIN seminar. Thanks. Take care.